You're listening to The Spear, a podcast about the combat experience from the Modern War Institute at West Point.
More than 100 meters outside the village, you were definitely getting in a firefight.
My first patrol I took, we had a far ambush.
And then it was just a huge explosion.
The primary threat was RKG-3 grenades.
Light machine guns and AK-47s, that kind of thing.
Small arms fire, RPG fire.
Explosively formed penetrators.
Suicide bombs.
And then that's about the time that the third IED went off.
And that's when another grenade comes spinning over the side of the wall.
And it's at that point the IED chain detonates.
There was enemy in the wire.
There's all these Humvees on fire.
It was truly bullets flying from every angle that you could see.
I open the door and look outside, and all I see is muzzle flashes.
There's a guy on top with a 240, and the rounds passed right past his head.
At that point, our instincts kicked in.
One pilot on the controls, the other pilot was using his M4 to engage single-man targets on the ground.
You're shooting at everything.
It was a fight.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of The Spear. I'm your host, Dr. Charlie Faint, and today's guest is Ayman Kafel. Ayman, welcome to the show.
Hey, Charlie. How you doing, bud?
Doing well. Ayman, thrilled to have you. I've wanted to have you on the show for a long time. You and I have been friends for a number of years. You have an amazing backstory, your experiences in the Army and as a police officer, and what you're doing external to that. So I think I'd like to start with you just sharing your origin story with our audience. Can you talk about what your childhood was like, how you grew up, and what prompted you to join the Army?
Yeah, so my family came to the U.S. in the late 80s, so we're immigrants, and we escaped literally two civil wars on two different continents, one in the Middle East, which is in Lebanon, and one in Liberia. We were actually living in Liberia at the time when Charles Taylor started the civil war in Liberia. We literally, my dad told me a few months back, he said, you know, we had only hours to escape because the forces were just coming right into the capital, because that's where we lived in Monrovia, and they were just killing everybody. And, you know, I have some really early memories of, a soldier getting blown up. I've had memories even in Lebanon of artillery shells hitting the mountains or the hills near the village where we lived. Also with guerrilla groups in the village coming in and out of the village and me running to my parents and crying and all that. So I was very, very young, but, you know, it's interesting. It's just like these are the memories that stick to me. You know, one thing I always found interesting is I don't even remember getting on the plane in Liberia and coming to the U.S. Like, I don't remember. I don't remember how the escape was. I don't. And it's one of those things, a friend, you probably know, retired Lieutenant Colonel Scott Mann, he asked me a question once, which I found really interesting. He said, what are your conscious memories? I was like, oh, I like how he said that. Conscious memories versus repressed memories, right? So memories that we just block out. So those are the types of memories of my childhood. And coming to America was very different for me because first we go from African heat to December in Boston. For those of you who are from Boston, December is not for the faint of heart. It's really cold. And seeing my first snowfall and Santa Claus and an actual TV that works and electricity 24/7. So it was a very, very different world for my family when we first came here. My father worked three jobs to make ends meet. We lived in a small studio apartment in Alston that I do remember because it was me, my brother at the time, my mom and dad, and both my uncles. The reason we came into Boston is one of my uncles had a student visa to Suffolk University. He was studying computer engineering. So my dad obviously went to where he knows, and I still mess with my dad to this day. I'm like, man, why didn't you pick a warmer climate? I mean, we got 50 states in America. Why don't we go somewhere south instead of the cold weather of Boston? But you know, he came to where he knew. You know, he knew he had, you know, my uncle here, and there was a pretty good sized Lebanese community in Boston anyways. So that's why we came. And fast forward a little, I grew up kind of typical growing up, trying to figure myself out, figure out, you know, where I am, you know, kind of who I am at the time. Got into martial arts early on in my childhood, and that sort of, I always say, that sort of developed me in a way. I think if it wasn't for, you know, if it wasn't for my martial arts school, for me and my cousins, actually, we'd probably be, who knows where we'd be, maybe in jail somewhere else, who knows, because we were hellions when we were kids. So So my martial arts at the time was called Shorinru Karate, run by Sensei James True. I actually still talk to him now, still to this day, kind of like a second father figure for us, you know, just the way he took us in and trained us and everything. You know, then fast forward more and college came around, and actually I was a very big fan of neuroscience, neurophysiology. I really enjoyed studying that. You know, I got into it in high school, psychology 101, 102. I really was like, oh, wow, this is so cool. And it kind of sparked my interest on learning how the brain works and how the body responds to stress and stuff like that and different diagnoses. I actually was working for a psychiatrist for a while just to kind of learn the job and everything. And 9/11 happens. And that's when a lot of guys my age took the oath, country called for us, and deployed overseas. And at the time, we only had a green card. You know, I only had a green card, so I was allowed to join the military with a green card at the time, and went to Iraq. You know, quite the experiences. I'm sure we'll get into some of the experiences I had in Iraq. But I went into Iraq as an NCO, and the way I got promoted to sergeant is actually pretty interesting. I remember I was a specialist at the time, and we were in the mess hall, you know, getting ready for the troops to come. And, you know, we had KP duty that day, and I'm sure you know of KP duty, which is a wonderful, wonderful duty to do because you're up early in the morning and you got to set up everything. And I remember a bunch of privates, we were just kind of sitting around, and guys were moving slower than usual, and I was like, hey guys, let's go step it up, you know, let's get the salt, pepper, you know, napkins, blah 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 blah. And I remember the sergeant major at the time, Sergeant Major Young, which I'm still very good friends with, remember him noticing that, and he whispered something to another NCO. And a few months later, you know, I got promoted to sergeant, and I deployed as an E5.
Oh, amazing. What MOS did you enlist in?
So at the time, I really didn't care. I just wanted to go fight. So the first billet that came up was field artillery. So I was like, blow shit up. Great. Let's do it.
So were you still in college when you enlisted?
Yeah, it's funny. So when after September 11th happened, obviously recruitment was an all-time high. So all the services were in my college, you know, Army, Marine, Coast, like everybody. They all had set up booths. And I went to the first one I saw, which was the Army National Guard. I'm like, oh, I was like, hey, what can you do for me? And what can I do for you? And they said, hey, we'll pay for college. We'll pay for this. Sign me up. That got it, you know. And not knowing much about the U.S. military and how it really worked, I mean, other than Rambo and other movies, but nothing really. I mean, no one in my family has ever done any sort of military service, so to me it was like a new thing, and I felt I needed I had this urge that I needed to join.
How did your family react when you told them that you were joining the Army?
Oh, it was not good. Part of it is, yes, you know, worry. Country was at war. Soldiers were deploying everywhere. Marines were deploying everywhere. And I understand part of it. But the other part was the cultural piece. Like, why would you go basically fight your own people, so to speak? My response to that was always, I'm not fighting my people. I'm fighting the bad ones who hijacked the culture, the religion, and everything, and turned it into this extremist ideology where it's okay to kill women and children, where it's okay to kill civilians who have nothing to do with anything, who just want to live their lives. But that's how these extremists rule. They rule through extreme violence and extreme fear. And I felt it was my job as someone from that part of the world who speaks the language to help my fellow soldiers to differentiate between the enemy and the civilian.
So you went from thinking about neuroscience in college to enlisting. So you're probably a couple years older than your peers. What was that adjustment like, going from the college room to basic training and then on to Iraq?
Holy shit. It was a slap in the face, basic training. So I did the delayed entry program. I did want to finish my semester up. So I didn't want to just stop and that's it. I at least wanted to get through half my semester. So I did the delayed entry program. So I didn't go to basic till September of 2002. I went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma. Now, this is from a guy who's never left Massachusetts, really, who only knew, like, you know, my culture and the Boston culture and the New England culture. That's it. That's all I knew. So to go across the country to Oklahoma was like nerve-wracking, because time, if you think about it, I didn't really have that much support at home. I was kind of this lone ship in this vast ocean, so to speak. So I had to kind of figure out as I went. You know, I mean, most of the guys that I was in basic with, they come from a family of soldiers. They come from, you know, some sort of military type background. So for me, I had no idea what I was in store for. I mean, I did know that, I mean, my recruiter was at least honest on that aspect, saying, listen, they're gonna like tear you to pieces in basic. Like, it's not easy, but thousands have gone through it. You'll be fine, you know, type of ordeal. And one thing I'll never forget is when I got to Fort Sill, we did like I think it was a week or 2 weeks worth of kind of getting our gear, getting ready before we go across the tracks, which, you know, when they say go across the tracks, that's like the basic training area. So we grab our things, you know, whatever. And I'll never forget, we were in there at the time there. I don't know if they're still doing that, but cattle cars. We loaded in cattle cars. I don't know if they're still doing that, but we loaded in cattle cars and we're going across the tracks. I'll never forget this one kid from like Kentucky, rural Kentucky. And he was like red. And I'm like, hey, you okay, dude? He's like, my recruiter said I was going to stay in a hotel room. I'm like, buddy, you got screwed. So it was a really like the shark attack. It was very holy crap. Like, what did I get myself into?
2002, the country's still pretty raw after 9/11. Your name is Ayman Kafel.
Yeah.
You show up for basic training with a bunch of folks who probably are similar situation to you in that they'd never been outside their hometown, their area. What was that like for you? Did you have any problems as a result of that?
No, actually. Because at the time, like, you know, some people in the community were saying, Lebanese community or Arab community were saying, they're going to be racist to you. You're going to get treated like shit. You might get killed because blah, 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 blah. So I had all these negative thoughts, you know, going through my head, and it couldn't have been the total opposite. Mm. Like, it was truly one of the most welcoming things I've ever seen in my life. You know, that's what really made me love the military even more, because, you know, one of the first speeches the drill sergeant said while smoking us, like doing push-ups, like, I don't care if you're black, white, Asian, whatever, we all bleed the same blood, we all bleed green, we all bleed red, put your biases aside because you only have each other out, you know. So it really captured what it truly meant to be an American to me, is like everybody working together for this idea of freedom in America and what America truly symbolizes.
I'm really glad to hear that. That was my experience in the Army as well. It's one of probably the only true melting pot left in America. It's so easy to self-segregate anywhere you go. It's sit with the same people. You think the same people. In the Army, you kind of got to get along with everybody if you're going to succeed.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really, you know, one of the things we would say whenever we're getting spoked is when they say up, attention to detail, down, teamwork's the key, up, attention. So you do that 100 times, that will sink right in real quick.
Yeah, build up some good upper body strength along the way.
Oh yeah, exactly.
Okay, so you did your basic training. You're now a fully qualified field artilleryman. What was the timeline for you and your unit arriving to Iraq?
Oh, not long after basic. I mean, we got our MOB probably towards the end of so I graduated basic maybe January, February of 2003. Because I did basic and AIT, so I did the whole OSET, you know, one station training. Went back to my unit, would do the one weekend. Well, it wasn't really anymore one weekend because we were at war, so we would go 4 or 5, you know, they'll call it MUTAs, E3s, MUTA4s, MUTA5s, which means you're gone for like 4, 5, 6 days at a time.
Wow.
Every month, because obviously deployments are really ramping up, so we're probably next in line because we're a combat arms unit, right? So they kept us training. So we would, every month I'd go away for like 3, 4, 5 days. And shortly thereafter, like June of 2003, we started getting wind that, hey, we got a deployment, orders are coming down, prepare. So then several months later, we finally get our orders like maybe April of 2004, we got our MOB orders and we knew we were going to go to Fort Dix, New Jersey. And then from there, we, you know, do our training and then deploy.
When you were preparing and in your early deployments, were you preparing to go as artillerymen or were you retrained in something else?
So, yeah, we were retrained. So what we knew is we were going to go under an MP battalion. It was going to be, MP brigade. I was going to be under the 18th MP brigade, and that we knew we were going to go under their flag and link up with a battalion, the 793rd MP battalion out of Germany. And we knew where we were going to go, and we knew we were, you know, set to deploy there. That was like one of three missions that we would do: detainee ops, force protection, or patrols. Those were the three mission sets that we went to. Now, the FOB we went to is called FOB Spartan. And the under the battalion, you had the MP battalion, but then the units were two field artillery units and a tankers unit. So that was kind of under the battalion, and then you got the headquarters. Before I get too ahead of myself, when we were at Fort Dix, so the training really revolved around CQB, combat ops, and detainee ops type work.
How did you feel about going from field artillery into that type of role? Did you feel comfortable that you were adequately trained in that before you had boots on the ground?
Yeah, I mean, the training at Fort Dix was really good. I mean, they ramped us up. They were, you know, scenario after scenario. I mean, they would throw field artillery simulators at us to do stuff, and like, it was amazing the stuff that they had us do. They had role players. They had role players with us who were from Iraq or some sort of folk Arabic and stuff. So got to know them a little bit, and it was a really good training.
Okay, this is your first deployment, your first trip to combat. In 04, that was my first deployment as well. So it's very new for all of us. So what kind of thoughts did you have before you went in there? Do you remember what you were thinking, what your mindset was like before you had your first combat mission?
Yeah, I mean, my mindset was, this is what I trained for, this is why I'm here. I hated staying behind the wire. I wanted to be out. I wanted to work because I was there. That was my purpose. My purpose was to be outside the wire, to work, to basically figure out what my role is going to actually be. So it took a couple months when I was in country. I mean, we knew we were in a combat zone when mortars, when we landed, well, it was a combat landing, a combat drop. So, you know, with the C-130 that just freaking almost crash lands as you know, to avoid getting shot down or anything like that. So that was my first, like, holy crap, landing there, and then the mortars. And I remember E7 Sergeant First Class, you know, welcome to Camp Anaconda, otherwise known as Mortar City. You know, and sure enough, you hear boom, boom. I'm like, yep, I'm at combat. You know, like, you hear the distant explosions and firefights and whatever else, because back then, I mean, yeah, it was still a war. You know, we were still fighting, especially with Al-Qaeda and various other groups that wanted a piece of America, you know. So my mindset was, I got a job to do, time to do it.
So I remember the MPs in Iraq doing a lot of route clearance and things like that. Was that something that you were into also?
No, so it was interesting. Kind of a month or month and a half into the battalion, when we were there, battalion commander was walking around, just getting to know all of us, being, you know, a good leader that he is, still is. And he kind of shook my hand, and he's like, hey, what's your name? And said, hey, Sergeant Kefell, sir. And he kind of got talking, and, you know, one thing led to another. I told him, yes, sir, I'm Lebanese, I speak Arabic. And he's just stopped and looked at the command sergeant major, and essentially I got plucked from my unit and just worked directly for the battalion commander.
Oh, amazing. So yeah. were you a translator, an assistant, a PSD? What was your role?
Yeah, so I was assigned to the PSD. They were called the Praetorians. So I was assigned to the PSD. He was Spartan 6. I was Spartan 6 India. Basically, I was his translator and his bodyguard all at once.
Okay.
I got to really see big army in terms of planning of ops and stuff like that. And I didn't realize, me being 22 years old, how integral my job was to the mission. And to the mindset and to the hearts and minds and all these things, because, man, unit after unit sought me out that would come to RAO, and the battalion commander would just loan me out to different units, whether I remember I briefed an SF unit, Marine counter intel, just different units that would come by, and I would give them the intel that I had, you know, because we were always out. And that's one thing about that battalion commander. His methodology was, we will always be out there. We will always hunt the bad guys. We would do our jobs. And he was no stranger to being number two in the stack. And I'm like, whoa, you know, like, you got the battalion commander, you know, clearing a room with me. So he was that kind of leader, you know, like, he wanted to be in the fight if there was ever a fight. And he told us, like, one of the speeches he told us, you know, towards the end of the deployment, he said, you know, you guys did a great job, blah, 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 blah. But I know you knew that if you were to take me out of a combat situation, I would kick your asses right away, you know, because our job was to protect him and get him out of there because he's the battalion commander. But yeah, there was no short of, I mean, missions that he had. And, you know, I would remember, like, be up at, you know, you'd hear him on the radio just calling for us, like, hey, mount up. It'd be 2 a.m, roll out, do some night patrols and stuff like that, because he really wanted to keep his thumb out there, pressed on all the things.
That's so smart. I remember early in the war, and certainly later in the war when the Iranians got involved with their copper-faced IEDs, that there was a tendency to want to button up because we thought we were safer on the fobs. But aggressive leaders like the ones you had, certainly the ones that I had in Iraq, knew that you were safer when you're out there getting the job done and not conceding the initiative to the enemy.
Yep, exactly.
Very good. And I appreciate the smack talking at the end. I'll fight all of you. All right, sir.
Yeah, exactly. No, he's a good dude. You know, I still talk to him to this day.
Oh, that's great. Well, it sounds like that you had basically an apprenticeship, a front seat view of good leadership in action. Do you think that's a good characterization?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, between the command sergeant, battalion command sergeant major, the battalion commander, and even got to know the brigade commander and brigade sergeant major. I mean, they were all very phenomenal leaders in terms of being clear on the mission, commander's intent, giving the NCOs the empowerment to do our job. That's the thing. Even though he was the battalion commander, our whole PSD squad were all NCOs, maybe a couple specialists, but majority of us are NCOs. And the battalion commander stayed out of our way when we were working. The only time he would step in if he needed to step in as a battalion commander to get clearance, to get whatever we need in terms of assets. But for the most part, he let us run the squad. You know, squad leader was the squad leader. I was his, you know, translator / bodyguard. Whatever we say goes. And that's it. That's just the way he ran it.
Amazing. You mentioned commander's intent, which I think is so important, especially if you have a high-performing team with motivated individuals. You give them the intent kind of loose, and you can be surprised by what they'll deliver for you.
Yeah,
and it sounds like he had the same attitude with you all.
Exactly. And that's the thing, I think. You know, even when we would take these long drives from like point A to point B to do, you know, our talking to the village elders or whatever it might be, he would give us lessons as we're driving, you know, as we're going. He would talk to us about, you know, force protection. Hey, Kafel, what's the blah, blah, blah? And he, you know, he'd go right into it. Talk to me about, you know, different maneuvers. And he, in a sense, like his gun truck that I was assigned to was a wealth of just knowledge and information that he would just pass to all of us.
Well, you must have made a pretty good impression, not only on the commander, but the sergeant major and the other senior NCOs in your unit, for them to put you on the detail. I get it that you speak Arabic, and that's definitely an asset. But that doesn't get you a ticket to the types of things that you were doing. So it sounds like you must have been pretty good as a soldier, an NCO, when you were over there.
Yeah, I always tell people, I'm like, just because I spoke Arabic does not make me a good soldier.
Right.
What made me a good soldier is being competent and all that. And I think having that competency and being kind of on my A game at all times, or I try to be at all times on my A game, they saw that. And they saw my drive. And they saw the type of man I am, the type of soldier I am. And you know, so I think that really helped.
So how did the battalion commander or any of the units that you worked with utilize your language skills?
A lot of, I call them asset development, or you know, kind of go out there, gather intel. I would put together, like, let's say a goodwill mission and give out supplies to the villages. And what I'd do is I'd walk around to talk to the village elders and the men and just kind of get to know them, write stuff down, kind of keep stuff in my mind, like, oh, okay, this is what this guy says, this is what that guy said, and they kind of compile all that intel together and send it up to the JTTF. And at the same time, you know, I'd have Marine counter intel. We went and they were working with a guy who would tell us how the IEDs were being built and how they would, you know, the tripwires and all those things. And there was a bomb maker in RAO that was really responsible for a lot of soldiers dying.
Wow.
Yeah, and we ended up finding him just on happenstance, because we were doing our night patrol. And I'll never forget the colonel's, you know, the colonel was just say, hey, Hyman, go talk to these guys and talk to them. And then one of them, I said, hey, what do you do for work? And he says, oh, I'm a metal worker. And I told the battalion commander, he's like, that's the son of a bitch we've been hearing about. He's the one, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, ooh, like, okay. So now we have a face with the intel that we've been gathering about this bomb maker who's a metal worker who's been helping up to time as Al-Qaeda of Iraq get materials for their IEDs.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
So was more of your translating direct translation person to person, or like you just described, hey, this is kind of what I want you to do, go talk to these folks and leave it up to your own devices?
Pretty much, because I've always told them, like, translating in Arabic is like, if I was to translate word for word, no way. Because there are certain words in Arabic, there is no meaning in American.
Okay.
So I would get, again, because of the type of guy I was, I guess, is the colonel trusted me to, you know, he'll kind of sit there for a second for 5-6 minutes as I'm talking, and then I'll, hey, this is what they said, XYZYZ and whatever. And then I'll be like, all right, colonel, he'll say, okay, ask him this. And then I'll work it in. And one thing is, you know, I always tell people, I'm like, listen, culturally, before you get into any intel, you need half hour to an hour of just shooting the shit. Like, you know, that's just the way it is. Like, you gotta be patient, and it takes time, because the one, they want to vet you and get to know you, and two, you're also getting to know their mindset and who their allegiances are with. And so, because those are all extremely important in the intel world, from what I learned from the colonel, you know, just that information is critical to know who is what and where.
Absolutely right. Did you have a specific mission that you were there to do? Like, we have to secure the city, or we have to do route clearance, or did the missions change regularly?
Oh, they changed all the time. Yeah. I mean, it's funny, the colonel, if it wasn't a combat mission, it was a patrol to some village to talk to an elder or drive, because he had a huge, under the battalion, we had a huge AO, like it, we stretched all the way up to Mosul. So we'd even drive all the way up to Mosul to get with those units, you know, under his command, and talk to them, and then drive around Mosul to kind of get a layout of the land. And it was a very vast AO that we had.
That's pretty dangerous. I remember Mosul being pretty sporty, and anytime you're on the roads, you're pretty vulnerable.
Oh, yeah. We went to Tal Afar too.
Oh, wow. Tal Afar
was pretty bad. So, yeah, so it was 40 a lot of times.
So when we're in uniforms, I mean, they're designed to make us all look the same. And when you have your helmet on, your glasses, I mean, we all look the same. And sometimes it's hard to tell men from women. So yeah. when you were out, before you started speaking, did the locals know that you were ethnically Arab?
No, because again, you're wearing, like at the time we were wearing those big goggles, helmet, because of the sandstorms or whatever. And yeah, no, they couldn't tell who's who.
Were there any times that worked to your advantage?
Yeah. I'll give you a funny story. We were going across, I believe it was the Euphrates River, on our way to Camp Anaconda from our base. It was like a big supply base, obviously, and we get fuel and go back to our base and stuff like that. And there was something going on the bridge, kind of to cross over the Euphrates. I don't remember exactly if it was the Tigris or Euphrates. And I remember, you know, we pull up, and obviously as a unit, you don't want to sit long, right? Because that's how you get pop shots or ambushed or whatever. Or, you know, the Al-Qaeda or insurgency would set up like an accident purposely to stop you from moving to get on you. So, you know, we come to a stop, and, you know, at the time I was in the gunner position because our gunner was on leave. So I took the gunner position and I was with a different squad at the time. We were doing a supply run. So I would sometimes, and for my unit, if they needed me to fill in, they'd go to the battalion commander. And if we got really nothing crazy going, yeah, they'll go take, you know, go ahead. So I remember I was sitting up at the up at the gunner position, and a squad leader asked, hey, Sarge, ask him what the hell's going on over there. So now, I speak Arabic. I'm looking at this Iraqi army guy. He speaks Arabic. And I ask in Arabic, hey, what's going on over there? And he looks at me and he says in English, sorry, I don't speak English. And I'm like, in Arabic. I'm like, okay. In Arabic. Then I'm like, okay, how about we speak Arabic? And it clicks with him. He's like, okay. And I asked, you know, what is going on? And he told me there was an accident. They're clearing up right now. I said, all right, well, get a move on. Clear it up, because we're going to go. And they did it, and we got through. It really... I mean, the Iraqi army also, like, when they found out I speak Arabic, it was like a welcome embrace. I remember going to the French embassy for a meeting with my company commander. We had a meeting at the French embassy in Baghdad. So I went along, and, you know, the force protection around the embassy was Iraqi army. And I sat, and I remember pulling up, and, you know, the sergeant was a good friend of mine. The staff sergeant, good friend of mine, we get out. He's like, hey, Ayman, tell him, you know, why we're here and you know, work with them, set up kind of every other guy, be an American soldier, Iraqi army, stuff like that. That way we get this place secured. I said, yeah, no problem. Go up to them, talk to them, and they were like, holy shit, whatever you want. So I was working with them, and they brought out like food for us and juice boxes and water and all kinds of crap. And my squad leader at the time, my squad leader was like, I mean, you are an asset, dude. This is amazing. We even got a tour of the Arnold Schwarzenegger gym, by the way.
What?
Yeah, it was right next to the French embassy. Now, I don't know if it's copyrighted or whatever, but that's what it was called, the Arnold Schwarzenegger gym, because they had his picture everywhere, and his pictures were all, and there's a file. I'll send you later. I have a picture of me and a kid, and you see the Arnold Schwarzenegger's poster in the background, and it was pretty funny, and that's when, you know, it really hit me about bridging that gap between two cultures. You know, I was sort of that bridge between two cultures to help, again, differentiate between the good and the bad.
You mentioned that you work closely with your battalion commander, which is rare for a young NCO.
Yeah.
You also mentioned your company commander. Did you have a lot of interactions with the junior leaders, the platoon leaders, the lieutenants?
Yeah. I mean, not as much, because since I got pulled and worked with the battalion commander, I mean, a lot of the like second lieutenants, first lieutenants, they knew who I was. So they would defer to my judgment in terms of, you know, outside the wire type intel and stuff like that. But for the most part, I was so busy with the battalion, because he was one busy dude. I don't know if he even slept, like, because we were really busy. I mean, on times where it days off, it was nice, because, man, I would just relax. Like, I needed that day up, because sometimes you felt like you were running like 20 hours straight, you know, because, wow, man, it's combat, you know. So you're just out there doing your job and working with various units and kind of working with the colonel, with the Iraqi army and the Iraqi police, just kind of figuring it out. Because it was still, I mean, if you think 05, I mean, 03 we did the invasion, so 05 is still relatively, we're still trying to figure everything out, you know. Nothing was really set in stone then.
That's right. Well, Ayman, you've given us several examples of good leadership, but I'm sure you're exposed to some bad leadership as well. You don't need to drop names, but can you think of a couple of examples where you saw something that was like, hey, when I'm in charge, I'm definitely not doing that?
Yeah, I mean, what I hated was bringing stress, even more stress, onto the base, like onto the soldiers, that was really not necessary. I mean, as stressful as is just being outside the wire, just doing our jobs. Now, if a soldier really messes up, it is what it is. We're going to do what we got to do. We're NCOs. We hold the standard. We hold a high standard. It's right in our creed, right? And, you know, no one is more professional than I. That's the very first sentence in the NCO creed. And that's the thing, is we still kept those standards up. But in a way, for me, seeing certain NCOs, certain platoon leaders, whatever, even company commanders, treat their men in a way that I'm like, man, that sucks. Like, screaming at them, and it would be over, really, to me personally, nothing really crazy, right? It wasn't insubordination, it wasn't anything like that. It was just dotting the I's, crosses the T, and, you know, it just minor stuff. And at certain points, you know, yeah, you keep the standards high, but at the same time, there's certain standards I would allow to be laxed on, because especially if guys were running ragged, I'm not going to yell at somebody for not shaving, right? That's like, okay, get to it when you get to it, because I understand you. But I mean, I'll give you another example. Actually, one time we were out running and gunning for a while, go to Camp Anaconda. We wanted a hot meal, like a good meal. Eating MREs really sucks. So when we got to Anaconda, we wanted a nice meal. Now, we were dirty. I had a slice scruffy. We were all scruffied up and whatever. And battalion commander, you know, he's like, hey, guys, leave all your weapons in the truck. I'll stand by. Go eat and just bring me a plate. That's, again, good leadership, right? You're like, oh, cool, thanks, sir. And because he was equal as hungry as us, right? Because he was in the gun truck with us. So we went to the mess hall, and there was this command sergeant major, very, very clean cut, clean press, uniform pressed and starched in a combat zone, right? And he turned us away. He said, you are not going to my mess hall looking like that. You got to clean yourself up, blah, 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 blah. We're like, all right, we turn around and come back. And the colonel saw us. We're kind of defeated. We're like, man, all we wanted was a hot meal. Like, that's all. And he's like, what happened? And we're like, well, sir, command sergeant major wouldn't let us go in because we dirty. And he's like, yeah, I'll take care of that. He went to the command sergeant major. I've never seen someone get stand a position of attention so fast And Colonel came back, whatever he said to him, he said, and said, go get you a meal. And I said, thank you, sir. And nice. Again, example of two leaders, one really good, the other one, you know, yes, as NCOs, we stick to standards, but at the same time, know what your soldiers have been through, know what they're doing. I mean, you see a group of 12 soldiers who just look ragged because they have been running for a while. Yeah, let them get a good meal in advance. That right there is a morale booster all on its own. Just to be able to sit down, go to the grill line, be like, dude, give me a cheeseburger. Like, give me something real to eat, you know? And it was great. And we brought him a plate of food. He ate his food. And we, you know, Charlie Mike went on, continued our mission.
I think that's another great example of leader's intent. I think it makes a lot of sense to ensure that people are healthy and clean going to chow. You don't want to spread disease.
You want to
make sure you maintain discipline. At the same time, understand that these guys aren't coming from the MWR hut playing Call of Duty all night long.
They've
been out on patrol. So maybe you go approach them. Hey guys, you know, hey, what's up? Hey, we just got back from patrol, whatever. We're going right back out. All right, great. Great. Come on in.
That's it.
Yep. Make sure you wash your hands, you know, get your cheeseburger, have a good day, man.
Even if he said he didn't want us to eat in the mess hall because he was washing your hands, and then we were all going to grab to-go plates anyways.
Right.
You know, that was kind of the intent of the battalion commander, like, hey, go grab your plates and bring me a plate with you. And that's it. Like, it wasn't like we were going to sit long because we needed to refuel and get back to our base. So we were on a strict timeline too, but the colonel told us, no, go sit in that mess hall and eat. Like, you know, because I think he just wanted to also teach that command sergeant major, like, hey, men and women out here are running ragged.
Yeah.
If they need a hot meal because they just got off a long patrol, man, let them. It's okay. It's okay.
You know? We'll all be okay. That's right.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And another example is actually stateside. I remember we went to Fort A.P. Hill, and this is me kind of coming back after combat, after, you know, being deployed. And we had this battalion commander, probably one of the worst leaders I've ever had to work with. He was just one miserable, miserable guy. Miserable. You're talking like whatever's going on in his personal life definitely affected him as a leader. And he kind of took it out on all of us.
Ouch.
I'll never forget now, as a battalion commander, if you have an issue with a private or specialist, you go to the NCO, to the NCOs, and be like, hey, fix that, and we'll deal with it. It was a young private, and he was, you know, you're sitting at the time we were doing like a rifle range, you know, range days, zeroing our rifles, whatever. It's a boring day. It's not really like anything spectacular. So this private, you know, was sitting in the bleachers, and he nodded his head off, kind of, he fell asleep. Whatever, we do that all the time.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, when you're zeroing, you're sitting there. If you're not zeroing, you're just sitting there, right? Unless the NCO assigns you a task or tells you, hey, you know, do this, that. And at the time, we weren't really doing much of that. We were just trying, because it was actually the whole battalion. So we were, you know, I was a range officer, and various other guys were range. So we were busy trying to pump guys through, like, let's go. So we had no time to waste because we needed to get these quals done. And the battalion commander wanted them done that day, you know, without. So yeah, we, commander's intent, he wanted us to get it done. No problem. We'll get it done. Leave the NCOs to it. He goes up to this private and screams at him. Why are you asleep? Blah, 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 all that stuff. And, you know, whatever, dust settles. The privates and specialists see him on the next bleachers at the next range that no one's using, sleeping, right?
Ouch. Wow.
So what does that do for him as a leader for the junior enlisted?
That's instant loss of all credibility. First of all, for losing his temper over something. I mean, what's that guy supposed to be doing? He's not shooting. He's not being nap out, guys. So you're rested when it's time to shoot.
Exactly.
And then to be guilty of the exact same thing, that's hard to come back from a credibility standpoint.
Exactly. I mean, he had no credibility with us anyways. And that even made it worse. And thank God he retired, you know, a year or so later, because man, he was terrible.
Well, and the NCOs will also resent that type of behavior, first of all, for not setting a good example, and second of all, for getting in their business. And exactly as you said, if I had a problem with that, I'd grab the nearest NCO. It didn't have to be that guy's NCOs.
No.
And I'd be like, hey, is that guy supposed to be doing that right now? Because maybe he is. Maybe it's his time to nap out. Sir, he just got off a 24-hour guard shift. We told him relax a little bit.
Exactly.
And that's always smart. And it took me a long time to get there as well, Iman. I'm not going to try to pretend I knew that right as a lieutenant. But it's always good to ask questions first instead of react. And sometimes just ask the guy.
Yeah.
Hey, private, what are you doing? Sometimes that's all it takes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't need to yell at anybody. And that private probably adjusts his behavior. And I guarantee you, as soon as you walk away from that guy, the NCOs will descend and handle anything else that's residual. But
exactly.
Yeah, what a great example of bad leadership, Lyman. Thanks for sharing that with us.
Yeah. Yeah. No problem.
All right. So I want to get into what you did after your military service because it's fascinating work. But before I did that, I wanted to give you a chance. If there was any other events or ideas you had from your time downrange that you thought might be important to share with our audience.
I'll give you another example of actually a officer listening to an NCO, which really helped kind of help us as NCOs also work with the officers. We had a second lieutenant, junior officer. You know, we were in Kuwait. We were doing battle drills, stuff like that, scenarios and whatever. And, you know, one of the scenarios is we had to be up at O-Dark 30 to mount up and go hit a location. And I remember this second lieutenant, he was tied up trying to figure out to put in the timeline when the soldiers are going to eat, which we, all the NCOs got that. We're like, sir, we'll take care of that. You just give us the mission and the timeline. Don't worry about feeding the soldiers. That's our job. We'll work that into the timeline. And I think it kind of crystallized them like, oh yeah, I'm not the only one doing all the work. Like I have NCOs who will take care of the soldiers. All I gotta do is put the op plan together. I'm like, after that, like that's all you need to do. So that's another example is like, you know, trust the leadership within your command to get the job done also. I mean, you can ask the NCOs, hey, did the guys eat yet? Yep, they're eating right now, sir. We gave them like 5 minutes, grab chow. And then we're mounting. You know, just let the NCOs let it flow because that's, again, when they say in the Army, the NCO is the backbone of the Army. It's 100% yep. True. Nothing gets done without the NCOs green lighting it, right? I mean, that's something a lot of officers, I think we weren't really battle tested as back then, really. I mean, yeah, 05, by then we were kind of established, but it was still kind of working out the kinks of the NCO Corps and the officer corps.
You wrap up in Iraq. What was homecoming like for you?
It was weird. You come from intense environment. You come home and then they're like, all right, you're all set. You know, yeah. 2 weeks demob. And we did not have any time to really decompress. I mean, I was still driving like as if I was driving in Iraq, you know? So there was no time to, and I think back then a big army did not realize how much trauma and pain the soldiers were going through, because one of the things they did, which I think was a horrible idea, was the VA would come in. I mean, you know, it was all check the box. All right. Yeah. You went to medical? Check. You went to psych? Check. You went blah, blah, blah. Oh, you're green on everything? All right. You get to go home. If you're red on anything, guess what? You're staying on base and you're not going anywhere till you're green. And you're like, hell no, I'm not going to admit to anything. You know, I just want to get home. So I think that was a mistake that Big Army did early on in the war. And it really hurt a lot of us because I remember getting an email. All of us, we got an email from a fellow staff sergeant. And I'll never forget the email. He asked one question and he said, guys, is anybody else angry? Like just aggressively angry? And that kind of was like, ooh, all right, I'm not the only one, you know, because again, think that, you know, I think, you know, physiologically and psychologically, we were trained to handle threats with extreme violence. And that transferred over into civilian life, which doesn't work too well. And there was never a mechanism to turn that off. It was just, you know, the only thing we were told, hey guys, you guys went to war, just so you know, I mean, the world's moved on and your kids are grown up and your brothers and sisters are grown up. And that's pretty much like, okay, cool, that's it. But when that extreme aggressiveness comes out all the time, I'm like, oh, this is not healthy. Something's not right.
I agree. And that early in the war, certainly Afghanistan had been going on for a couple of years, but only like two or three. And Iraq was in its infancy. And we didn't know what we were doing. Nobody did. And I think that your experience mirrors mine as well. I was an intel guy with 5th Group, came back, and nobody wanted to be in the very limited demob in quotes because we were active duty. No one wanted to be there. The people teaching it, doing it, didn't want to be that. I mean, it was very much check the block. because we didn't want to be hanging out anymore. We wanted to do whatever, be back with our families, go have a beer, whatever it was. And it happened for us so quick. A matter of days after I got back, I was at the beach in Florida at my cousin's wedding. And my cousin's brother, my male cousin, and I were drinking beer in the surf. And he was like, "So what was it like?" And that was really the first time I thought about it. I was like, "Holy crap." I went from go, go, go all the time. And now I'm back on the beach. And fortunately I had a good support network, and I was married to the woman I'm still married to. And I had a lot of support structure, but it made me think about all those poor guys that don't, and they go out and they abuse drugs. They engage self-destructive behavior. They buy a Ducati motorcycle, wrap it around a tree. There's a lot of that stuff going on. So I'm glad you survived all that.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, some of my squad mates, like you said, succumbed to drugs, died of overdoses, homelessness. One of them died right at the V homeless shelter in Boston. Yikes. You know, we all felt terrible, like, man, reach out for help. You get the whole, why didn't he reach out? And I think it's just, we were built in a way that, strength is our number one thing. I think a recent article that just got posted on Havoc Journal was talking about that silence, because of what Havoc Journal did for me with writing. And that's the thing. It's that silence is deadlier than actually speaking and writing about it.
Let's talk a little bit about that before we talk about what you did after military service and what you're doing now, because it's all closely related. So how did you process that? I'd like you to explain how you personally did it and any advice that you have for young leaders, NCOs, officers, whomever, about how to deal with their troops who have experienced what you experienced in combat.
I'd say for in terms of leaders on how to deal with troops who've seen combat is to really check in with them. I think if you stop for a second and ask, "Are you okay?" goes a long way. And not the, are you okay? Yeah, I'm fine. No. Are you okay? Like, strip the rank. You're not talking to a lieutenant, to a colonel, to a general anymore. You're talking to Iman, I'm talking to Charlie. Are you okay? Because that will really put the guard down of any soldier. Now, the guard's still going to be up, I'll tell you that, guaranteed, the guard, but you have to chip away at the layers, because we have developed multiple walls, multiple layers before you get even into what it is that's bothering your NCO or your junior enlisted or even your officer. You have to chip away, and it takes time, and it's not something that's going to just heal just like that. It'll never heal. The saying always goes, like, a part of me is always at war, no matter what. It's always in Iraq. No, like, that is something I've learned to accept, radical acceptance, this kind of philosophy of, part of me went to war, a part of me stayed at war, and that's it. And that's, I think, understanding those things on more of a deeper physiological level and psychological level will really help guide you as a leader in terms of what's going on with your soldiers and your troops or even policing your officers.
How did you process it yourself? What things did you do? I know that you're really into fitness. You're really into writing. Did those things help you out?
So when I came home, I didn't have any support network. None. I had to figure it out myself. For my own family to say, "Iman, why are you so angry?" I'm like, "Dang, I just got home and in my mind, I'm thinking, Staff Sergeant Worley died like a month before I came home. He got blown up by an IED on our way to hit a village." I was like, "That was a month ago, and I'm home and you're wondering why I'm so angry." And so there was a lot of work I had to do. It took over 20 years. It took 2 decades to figure it out through process of elimination. What works for me, what doesn't work for me. And I found that, to me, fitness and writing is really what helped me, because I got myself to such a dark spot that I realized it and I had to get out of it. And I'm like, I can't keep going like this. And I got to figure out what I need to do to work on myself. Because for me, traditional therapy is traditional therapy. Psychiatry. You go to the VA at the time, when I finally went to the VA in 08, I was given a rainbow rainbow pills, I call them, you know, Skittles. Here you go. Try all these. I was on 13 to 14 medications. And I was like, holy. And eventually, you know, when I got married, thank God for my wife, because she also pretty much saved me too. She really helped kind of chip away at the layers, kind of forcefully too. When the question of, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. No. Are you really okay? Yeah, I'm fine. No, you're not fine. Like, you know, talk, you know, she would force me to talk to her and really kind of come out of my shell as a result. And that's why she always says, you're a softie. I'm like, yeah, I'm a softie to you. You know, but it took a lot for her to work. If you think about it, like the aggressiveness that I had instilled in me, the rage, the anger, all that stuff. So to me, it was writing and the physical training, because I found such clarity when I would do that, and developing as a writer, developing as a philosopher, developing as reading Stoicism, reading, you know, a Book of Five Rings by Miyoto Musashi, reading Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. I think that helped me far more than any other religious books or anything, because to me, those were warriors talking to another warrior, right? Those were battle-tested individuals that figured it out hundreds, thousands of years ago, you know, before anything else. So to me, that really spoke to me.
I think you brought up two very important and useful things, not only for combat veterans, but for anybody, military first responders. First is writing. Write about it. Even if you don't share it with anybody else, it's therapeutic. If you do write it and share it, you'll find that many other people have the exact same feeling and experience as you do. You're not alone, homie.
Yeah. That's what I learned.
I agree. I think a lot of people in general, and vets in particular, they have two hangups. One, they don't think they have anything to say. They're wrong. And number two, they don't think they're good writers, which is probably true, but doesn't matter.
Listen, I'm sure early on, I probably wrote like a Neanderthal, because there were so many edits that had to happen. Really helped, you know, like over time, like I'll read some of my old stuff and I'm like, whoo, like, yeah, that I just see, like, you know, compared to now. But it's like anything, it takes practice, right? And it takes time to develop that skill set, like anything we do in the military or first responder, whatever. You know, these skill sets are developed over time. You know, no one became a Green Beret overnight, years of training. No one became an infantryman overnight, took months, years of development. Even as a cop, SWAT, like whatever, like what I do now, that took years of development. I just didn't wake up one day and say, oh yeah, I'm a SWAT operator now. Now I can go kick in doors. It doesn't work that way. You know, it takes time to train that skill set.
Well, I want to make one more point about something you said, and then I want to talk about what you're doing now in your first responder role and your side projects, and then we'll wrap it up. Yeah. But the other useful tool for leaders that you mentioned is picking up the phone and calling somebody.
Yeah.
Just do it. And it doesn't matter who it is. And this is something that my troops taught me. Several years ago, I got a call out of the blue from a soldier that tracked me down, that used to be one of my troops, and was like, hey, sir, because they still call me sir. Don't have to do that. You know, we're all out of the army now, but it's just the way we do things. Hey, sir, this thing happened and made me think of this other thing that happened. We worked together. Just want to let you know that I appreciate what you did for us. Whatever. It was like a 30-second conversation, but it meant so much to me. So I do that now. I'll randomly call people a couple times a year. I'll pick up the phone. It's like, who haven't I not talked to for a while? Yeah. And I think it's important to not forget our leaders as well. Those guys don't get any love, because first of all, we think that they never have any problems. Yeah. Second of all, we think it's weird for us to call our bosses. Just do it. You don't work for them anymore. They're not going to think you're kissing their butt. Give them a ring, check on your buddies, talk to each other.
Exactly. That's the thing is, even to this day, I tell, you know, which we'll get into policing and how, you know, I've shaped my leadership with policing. Even with police, and, you know, I take that NCO creed with me for my guys, you know, my guys and girls at the department. And as a sergeant at work, again, it's like the backbone of any police department. I don't care what anybody says. It truly is, because from the lieutenants on up, they have their missions or whatever, and they bring it down to the sergeants. And yeah, we're the ones who enforce that and get it going, you know, get that mission going, get what that task going or whatever. You know, you just leave it to the sergeants to get the job done with the officers.
I think this is a great time to segue into your experiences in law enforcement. And I'd like you to explain why you decided to go into law enforcement, what you're doing now, and perhaps anything that you thought was transferable from your time in the Army, especially your time in Iraq. to what you're doing now.
So it's funny, I never really had in my mind to become a cop. It was actually that buddy of mine, that staff sergeant, you know, with the French embassy. He was a cop himself. And while we were in Iraq, he was like, Ayman, you've got the eye. Like, you've got that intuition. You've got that really sixth sense about you that you would be phenomenal as a cop. And so I thought about it. I'm like, you know what? Yeah, why not? You know, I mean, it was one of those crystallized moments where I was sitting in the office at the psychiatry office. And I'm like, man, what the hell am I doing? I'm answering phone calls for insurance companies and whatever else and dealing with that stuff. And I'm like, nah, this can't be it. You know, this can't be the type of role I take on after war. I just didn't want to do that. So I ended up, so at the time in Massachusetts, if you were deployed back in 06, early on, if you were deployed, civil service would hold tests every month to become police officers. So that way you come home, you're able, as long as you show them your orders, good to go. They'll set you up with an appointment. You go take the test and good to go. So I did all that. So then became a cop, I worked in Boston for the Transit Police Authority, MBTA police. I started there with my buddy who was the staff sergeant. That's where I started my work. And then I lateraled to my current job in the city of Attleboro. And that's where I've been ever since.
Very nice. So when you made that transition, did you think that you fit in on the force as a former soldier?
Yeah, I mean, I was glad to see other veterans as, and you're talking this early, so these are Gulf War veterans, right? So the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War, where veterans were starting to make their way into policing. So a lot of the cops, veterans that I met were, some of them were Gulf War, but then you also had the peacetime veterans, you know, the 90s, you know, mid to late 90s veterans. So I was glad, like, I was sort of in the same company. I felt like, oh yeah, this is sort of military. This is sort of, you know, you have your chain of command and your commander's intent. And so you had those similarities in the military. So it was, for me, I felt it was an easy transition into that role.
Did you think that any of your skills as a leader or as a soldier assisted you in becoming a good cop?
Yeah. I mean, especially talking to civilians, because I got so used to talking to people out in a war zone, like in Iraq and stuff, that I didn't care. I talked to anybody, whether it's a gang member or whatever. I just go up and talk. And I developed that skill set of being able to extract information without them realizing I'm extracting information. That's sort of the skill set that I learned kind of trial by fire in Iraq, you know, with no real formal training on interrogation and interviewing and stuff like that. I just kind of figured it out as I went along. And as a cop, my rationale has always been safeguard the people, protect the Constitution. Like those are the things that, you know, I hold near and dear to me. And it transferred over kind of easily for me as a cop.
In addition to being a police officer, you're also an entrepreneur. Can you talk about your work, especially your leadership development piece?
Yeah. As I went through policing, I got on SWAT detective. I was a federal task force officer with the DEA, you know, and throughout that, I got to see a whole wide range of different type of leaders. Some that were ego-driven, which is the worst type of leader you could imagine, right? Ego-driven, and some that are more very laid back to the point where it's like, eh, I don't want to be that laid back, but to be more of a servant leader. That's kind of what I developed as, more of a servant leader. Like, you know, there was something actually recently I was listening to Mike Waltz on Sean Ryan. And he said something that I really liked, that he would always ask his troops overseas. And it was like three questions he would ask before any meeting gets done. And it's let me bring it up real quick, because it's really kind of sharpened. It really made sense to me, and it spoke to me on why he said, you know, how he said it. And that's sort of something I always bring. I've always asked, but not in his way. So what he says is, in his words, I would always end my staff meetings with my team on, what decisions are you waiting on from me? What resources do you need from me? And how can I empower you? Right? Just those three questions at the end of any meeting. I mean, so those are things I've always said, like during roll call, especially as a sergeant, I go around the room, hey, anybody working on anything? Anyone need anything from me? You know, anything needs to get done, any reports need to be approved, you know, that way I can get them out the door. right? Like, hey, whatever's standing by, go. I try to empower them as much as I can to make decisions out on the road. That's something that I learned in Iraq, like with the battalion commander who let us NCOs make those decisions, allowed us to make those decisions, because I think empowerment gives the officers under my command the ability to think outside the box, you know, where I tell them, listen, not everything is an arrest. Not everything is a ticket. Sometimes you got to figure it out. What if there's more to a story? Does it always have to end in an arrest? No, obviously, if it's something egregious, that's a whole different story. But, you know, you're talking minor stuff, but there's always more to any story. There's always more layers to peel. So that's something I've always kind of taken into, I always take into work, as well as, you know, my studying as an entrepreneur, like when I study neuroscience, stress physiology, and all those things. Like, I'm still a complete nerd with that stuff. So so anytime I see somebody tired or, you know, working a lot, I tend to give them a very easy assignment. I'll give you an example. We had an officer, she looked like she was so tired. She showed up to work in the morning, very tired. So I brought her into the office. I'm like, hey, you know, can I talk to you for a second? And, you know, it's funny. Everyone gets stuck, because I used to be that way. Get guard, like guarded. But I think that's the fault of leadership as a result, why you're guarded, because 9 times out of 10, you're getting called to the office because you're in trouble for something. It shouldn't be that way. It should be, hey, come see me. Hey, what's going on, man? You know, how's life? How's family? How's kids? You know, just know your people. You know, if you don't know your people, you don't know what's going on in their personal lives, especially in law enforcement, where we're always working together. So this officer, you know, she told me, oh, I was up all night. I had to go to the ER. I didn't get home till like 3 a.m. And, you know, now our shift is at 8. I was like, damn, so you only had like a couple of hours of sleep? And she's like, yeah, but, you know, I'm here. I was like, do you want the day off? Like, go home. I mean, we got more than enough officers. I don't have to call someone in on overtime or anything. You can take the day off. It's like, no, I'll work. I'm like, all right. So I gave her like a very easy, quiet beat of the city, kind of more rural. I said, all right, just go relax, like respond to your calls. Don't do anything like proactive unless you really have to, but just go relax, disappear. And that's it. Like, to me, that speaks a lot to the officers, because I want them to know that they're comfortable to come to me. Like, don't worry about it. Like, I get it. And I think they know my history of being the type of cop who's always out there. I was always working, always searching warrants, hitting doors on SWAT. So they know, like I'm battle tested, I guess, if you want to call it, right? Not to, you know, tap myself on the back or anything like that. But it takes, you know, within law enforcement, credibility goes a very long way. Just like in the military, credibility goes a very long way, where I will never make, like, an NCO, you know, the NCO in me comes out, I will never make you do something that I've never done. That is a standing rule with me. If I haven't done it before, you're not doing it. And it's funny, when I tell the officers that, especially the new officers that come onto my shift, I'm like, listen, I'll never make you do anything I haven't done, but I'll tell you right now, I've done a lot. So, so I kind of set that standard right away, and also not to lead through fear. I hate that. I absolutely hate that, because I've seen it. I see it in policing all the time, is that leading through fear. It's a ridiculous way to lead.
I agree. Well, I mean, I told you we were going to just go an hour and we busted that. I'm sorry for keeping you so long.
No, it's okay. It's okay.
But I would like to turn the mic over to you one last time for any parting thoughts you might have for leaders. As you know, in the sphere, leaders of all levels listen to this show, but particularly the young leaders. So no matter what walk of life they're in or where their leadership journey is, what are some things that you would like our audience to take away from Ayman Kafel's leadership philosophy?
So I'll sum it up to two phrases that I've learned and really like. So as leaders, we manage situations, we lead people. We don't manage people and manage situations. Managing a critical incident is very different than leading people. People are human beings. Every single one of us have different personalities. Every single one of us are different drives, different passions, different things. When you lead as a manager, that's, to me, more business oriented in our sphere. Like, we are not a business. Right? We are military first responders. It's not a business. We are dealing with really critical incidents where we're managing these things. For example, I'll give you a quick example. You know, dealt with a car, drove into a store, multiple hurt. I was, you know, I responded. I was sort of in charge of that whole scene initially, very critical incident. And all I was doing was managing the scene, moving my pieces around. Hey, officer so-and-so, go block that street. Hey, officer so-and-so, go block that side. That's managing the situation. I'm not managing them. I'm leading them. I'm telling them, hey, this is what I need to get done. And they go do it. Afterwards, as a leader, I debrief. Hey, what did you guys see? How did you guys handle this? What did you see, feel? Because it also gives them a moment to decompress after that intense incident where, you know, people were trapped under a car or whatever it might be that they were dealing with. Because me, I was the 30,000 foot view and taking care of managing the scene, right? And leading the officers to secure the scene, to rescue, and at the same time, fire department's there, they're doing their thing. So that's the thing with me is we manage situations, we don't manage people.
Excellent. Ayman, thank you so much for the episode today. I think our audience is really going to enjoy this. I appreciate your time, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
All right, thanks a lot, Charlie. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Spear. The Spear is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of the participants and don't represent the position of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. Be sure you're subscribed to The Spear on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app, where you can also give the podcast a rating or leave a review, which helps us reach new listeners. And if you aren't yet following MWI on social media, please find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks again for listening.